I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. There are times when I convince myself that I'm reading a novel for young adults only for the show, until I come upon one that speaks to me, and suddenly I'm reading it for myself. The same thing happens when I get caught up in a TV series that's obviously meant for a younger demographic. I think back to My So-Called Life, or before that, Wonder Years, right now on HBO, Made in America. These are all for people in a different age bracket than I'm in, but they speak to me. And the same thing happened to me with this book. It's called Four Seasons. It's described as a novel for young adults in four movements. It's divided up into spring, summer, fall, and winter. And it's the story of Allegra Katz. It's about her piano lessons at Juilliard and how that rigorous training and practice is both an honor and a curse in the life of this girl and perhaps many others. Author Jane Zalbin is the author-artist of more than 50 books. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Hi. How are you?
50 books.
Yeah. And I'm still standing. What can I, or sitting, whatever.
I know. Well, how old were you with the first one?
Well, I wrote it when I was 21, when I graduated college.
It was a young adult one?
No, it was a picture book that I wrote and illustrated, dealing with sibling rivalry. And I dedicated that one to my older brother, and who was at the time a psychoanalyst, and I threatened that I would leave it in his waiting room.
You're going to out him, right?
Right.
So let's talk about your character, Allegra Katz. I like this book so much.
Thanks.
So you're welcome. She's at Juilliard.
Yes, at pre-college at Juilliard.
Yeah, and she has musician parents, which of course sets up a certain tension, doesn't it?
Tension and pressure, yes, and knowledge of what she's doing. So, yes, it does, and particularly the pressure, since one, her father is a renowned concert violinist in the book, and her mother, I guess there's no way other than saying she's a failed opera singer who had been at the Metropolitan Opera briefly in her youth and is now... which doesn't mean that she's a failure, but that she's a blues singer in bars downtown in Lower Manhattan.
And I think she says something like it's breathing to her. She has to do it, even if she has to do it in dives.
Exactly. I mean, that music is like breathing air, which is what writing and art is to me. So.
Yeah, me too. So I'm curious about why you chose this topic.
Well, I guess several reasons. I was very serious about the piano, and Allie in the book, Allegra, who I call Allie, in the book is a pianist. She's a piano prodigy, which I was not, but I was pretty good at the piano. And then at 13, I remember, I guess that year between 12 and 13, I was studying a Rachmaninoff piece, and I was supposed to play it, you know, in front of the whole school. Then it was called junior high and not middle school. And I remember at the end of the year, I don't even remember vaguely what happened, but it didn't go through, and it wasn't because of me. I was practicing, and then the teachers or principal said, oh, we don't have the time. And I remember thinking, because I was also passionate about art from when I was very little, I was applying to the high school music and art and putting together a portfolio, and I said, I really don't like performing in public. Mm-hmm. It makes my hands sweat. It makes my legs sweat and stick to the seat. I don't like, you know, if people are talking when you've, you know, rehearse something for a year of your life, and then, you know, people, you know what happens in a concert. We've all been to them. So I decided to go for art. The second reason was I have two sons, and one, I guess when he was about in fourth grade, picked up the violin. He actually wanted to play the bagpipes. I said to him, what kind of Jewish boy plays the bagpipes? And I said, plus the fact, they don't really give bagpipes in school as an instrument. So he picked up the violin, and he actually discovered around 8, 9 years old, he liked it. The music teacher in the school, who actually had gone to Juilliard when he was a kid, you know, younger, for the flute, said to us, we're both non-musician parents, really, that you should do something with this child. And then by, I guess, about 10, he started getting involved with some of the teachers there at Juilliard, went away with them in the summer, and then by from 11 till when he went to college, he was there.
So your point being, you've been immersed in this world.
My point being, I slept on the floors at Lincoln Center many Saturdays.
Yeah, so you know the pressures. That's what this story is about, the pressures that are on these high-achieving kids who either choose the instrument or get pushed toward it.
Right.
And so the arc of Allie's character in this book goes from, it opens with her, you know, doing that thing of, oh, here I go, my palms are going to be sweating, I hate it.
Right.
You know, I'm breaking out in hives over what I have to do. And then how would you describe the arc of what happens to her without giving too much away?
Well, I will say, I won't say anything.
It doesn't really matter.
She does have a breakdown from the pressure, which I narrow down in the book. But there is a crescendo and it builds up. And there's a lot more in this book. I mean, it's funny. It's poignant, hopefully, you know, and sad and, you know, and all of those things that life has. But I guess the arc would be that Allie has to find for herself, is this her road? And is this her journey, or is it her parents, or is it her teachers, or is it for the outside world? In other words, you know, as we all have to find in life, what makes us happy? You know, what do we need, and what do we want, which is a very basic question of life.
This is Jane Zalbin. She lives in New York City and is the author of this novel for young adults called Four Seasons, and it's about a girl's experience at Juilliard in training as a pianist, wondering if she should continue despite her considerable talent. So it gets at a lot of things, because there's a cultural element here. There are some cultures and some, well, all kinds of parents who believe that a child shouldn't get to choose for a career what makes you, quote-unquote, happy, but what will help you make a living. And you can do the happiness thing on the side. And so for me, as I was reading the story, I was thinking a lot about that.
Well, as a human being and as a parent and just an individual, I'm diametrically opposed to that. And also being the mother of a violinist/film composer and another one who is a writer/actor/sketch comedy guy and also writes comic books. I mean, this is what my kids do for a living. They were also incredible in math and physics and could have both gone into that and probably made more money and not been freelance and not been struggling. But, you know, it's their life.
So there is, when you're good at something and people say, you're good at that, so you should do it. I remember a time in my life I was good at a particular thing, and I was pushed into it in the world of journalism, and I hated it. But I was really good at this thing, and I ended up doing it for 2-3 years. And finally I said to myself, this does not make me happy.
Right.
And so I'm going to go in this other direction in journalism. But it took me quite a long time. So you've raised this issue of, you can be really good at something, and because you are, you think you're supposed to do it.
Well, what I think is also, it's really harder and more courageous. It's braver to take a risk, to take a chance in life, which is what this girl discovers, you know, the protagonist in the book at her young age, and to do, hopefully, you know, with her life what, you know, what she wants to do, because life really, every day we spend our time in a certain way. So isn't it better, I mean, you know, and each person has to decide for themselves whether they want, you know, the money more, or they want to be happy, you know, and also, I've said to my own children, can they, you know, take that day-to-day struggle? It's much harder to be freelance. I mean, my husband is, and so am I. You know, so, but it's also, and that was not the paradigm I was given in life at all. So maybe this was my form of rebellion. But I really felt, how could I, as an artist and a writer, tell anyone, let alone my own children, what to do? I mean, that would be, I don't know, outrageous act to me.
Yeah, and do you notice that there are some cultures,
yes,
where, you know, you wouldn't dream of having your philosophy? They would think you were nuts.
I know.
you know, they would say, "What are you talking about?
I was one of the only parents at Juilliard who felt this way. And I think that's why I was able to write Four Seasons, because I felt like an outsider looking in instead of part of it. I was able to observe the parents, the competitiveness of them and the teachers, and really the, you know, what went on. I'm sure you know, if I was a parent observing, you know, whether it was soccer or ice skating or gymnastics, there might be a similar, you know, level of, you know, when children are that high up competing for very, you know, discreet spots, you know, that not many children get or young adults get, I think it gets very aggressive.
And you do see, don't you, Jane, that there are parents, you know, some parents that live their lives through their children.
Well, that's what the mother does in this book initially. Mm-hmm. I mean, because she doesn't feel successful. It's her story, too. It's the father's story. It's the grandmother's. It's her best friend's in the book. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, in a way, it's four novels in one because of the way I divided it up. What? There are many stories, and it's how all these characters, I guess, learn to find out what their quest in life is and what's going to make them happy, because in the end, I started thinking about, you know, I get frustrated, certainly. I'm not painting a rosy path as an artist, as a writer, you know, earning a living. But at the same time, you know, we all die in the end, and how are you going to do it? I know so many lawyers and doctors whose parents told them that's the way to go. And I could have done that with my children, and they could have done that with their lives. But I just felt like if that's what they chose and they were passionate about, and that's really the bottom line.
Yeah. Great to talk to you. Thank you so much, Jane.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is Jane Breskin Zalben, Zalben, and she is author of this novel for young adults. It's called Four Seasons, and it is a novel in four movements. Next, how the pepper spray incident at the Occupy movement created a whole design thing on the internet. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. You can follow our show guest schedule and talk with us on Twitter at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. Oh, are we going to have a conversation about some interesting things? Our regular contributor, design critic Steve Heller, is back, columnist for the New York Times, who writes a great blog on all things design called The Daily Heller. What do you think of when you see a Benetton advertisement in a magazine? Should photos in ads reveal that they've been manipulated to make the featured person look skinnier, etc.? What about featuring older people in fashion ads, plus the new thing swirling virally across the internet connected to the Oakland police pepper spraying nonviolent seated young people at Occupy Oakland? Steve, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to have you on the show. Let's talk about that Oakland thing. So the kids were all lined up, the young people, seated on the ground, and the police walked up and down and sprayed them all in the face with pepper spray, which is a horrifying thing to endure. When police are in training, they have to endure it, and they just say it is the worst thing. I have a police friend who said to me, if I flashed my gun, the perp wouldn't be as scared as if I take out my pepper spray. That's how frightened people are of how awful it feels to get sprayed. So after that happened, describe what went on the internet.
Well, first of all, I think you gave a great description. It's not a lethal weapon, but it certainly is a painful one. And I don't know about you, but I've been tear gassed in demonstrations back in the 60s, and that wasn't any fun either, and this is even worse. What happened after that event, that infamous event now, was that one of the leading police officers who was captured on film or on disc became the poster child of the spraying movement, as it were. And he was photoshopped in countless situations, spraying everything from Lassie to characters in great works of art. He was just imposed in almost any possible absurd situation, making him perhaps the most photoshopped character of the week.
You did send me some of them, and I hadn't seen this, and I was so fascinated that this is what people did to show a sign of protest. This is a very interesting thing to have happen in the design world connected to protests.
You know, it's interesting because it's been part of the political art and political protest scene since the 19th century, when collage became possible, when photography became possible, when montage became usable and reproducible. Characters were taken out of context and put into other contexts. John Hartfield, for example, was the inventor of political photomontage, and he would ridicule Adolf Hitler and all of his minions by taking them out of their natural situation and putting them into satiric situations.
Years ago, when I used to do art projects, this was way before the internet, I would take advertisements and I would sabotage them. So there might be an ad, a beautiful, gorgeous four-color ad in a magazine showing a woman sitting on the floor at the edge of the bed, and the bed had these gorgeous sheets, and so it was an ad for the sheets. And so I would find another ad, say of a seagull was in it, a big giant seagull, and I'd painstakingly cut it out with an X-Acto knife and then put the seagull in bed while she was sitting on the floor with the gorgeous sheets. And so I must have had 15 of these. And I had an art show of these. And I think back to the day, I thought, I did these by hand. Now it's you so easily can Photoshop something and insert it. If you looked at my work from, 25 years ago, you would think that I had done all of that on computer.
Yeah, well, you know, that was being done, and it was being done by Adbusters, the counterculture magazine today, where typical fashion ads or clothing ads were juxtaposed with horrible things going on in the culture or funny things going on in the culture as a form of ridicule and as also a form of underscoring the absurdity of what we are fed on a daily basis by advertising agencies.
I see. I was part of a movement and I didn't even know it. This is regular contributor Steve Heller, design critic, New York Times columnist, and creator of the design blog called The Daily Heller, which is always fascinating. Let's get to ads in magazines for a minute, because we're having a discussion the other day about whether photos in ads, photos of people, should in some way reveal to what extent those people, those living people, have been manipulated to make that either known or unknown model or personality look skinnier, more muscular, the way that you can do this with more beautiful, the way that you can do this with photoshopping now. I wonder what would happen.
Well, you know, there is such a thing as truth in advertising, so it's not that far removed from the idea of making exaggerated claims. I think people have come to accept the fact that the advertising agencies are going to airbrush pictures. I mean, everybody knows what an airbrush is. Everybody knows what retouching is. This was before the age of Photoshop. So the question is, as you say, should it be pro forma that people understand this? I mean, when an actor gets on television wearing a doctor's smock, it says, this is not a real doctor. Or he says, I'm a doctor on TV, but I'm not really one. Or I play a doctor. You know, so it's the same idea. On the other hand, advertising is known to be a medium of hype. And if you're advertising something that has real critical effect on the human body, let's say, like drugs and all, then you have to be as totally honest as you possibly can be. You can't just sell patent medicines and make claims. On the other hand, if you're selling pairs of pants or shirts or undergarments or whatever, it seems almost natural to exaggerate and to kind of say to the consumer, this is an exaggeration, is almost a redundancy, because you know when you try it on in the store, you're going to look quite different from the models in the ads. You might even look quite different from the mannequins in the window.
Yeah, well, this is a pointless discussion, isn't it, this question I've raised, because no one's going to do it.
Well, you never know. I mean, we did have prohibition in this country. Wasn't that really weird? And who would have thought that something like that could happen for 10 years?
I can't believe the extent to which I, and I'm sure other listeners, have come to accept this photoshopping. I mean, sometimes it's so badly done. It's so obvious. And then other times you will see, say it's a famous person, you'll see the famous person on television talking away, and that person looks this way, and then the magazine comes out and the cover shows the person completely differently. In a way, I just kind of accepted. I was like, oh yeah, there they are making this person look more beautiful, and there you go.
Well, let me ask you something. How many men and women have had work? You know, and it's so obvious that they've had work because their faces are stretched. You know, it's work. It's like, okay, they've had physical airbrushing.
Uh-huh.
It's part of life, you know, whether you agree with it or you don't agree with it, whether you like it or not. You know, I think ultimately there might be a government agency that's in charge of aesthetics, because there are so many people that come out of those plastic environments where their faces are changed slightly, and they don't look any better than they did going into it. So maybe there needs to be quality control. If you're going to do this, at least do it well.
Yeah, that's what I say. Do it really, really well, because I've seen it done so badly and in places that should know better, that should have design teams that do it much, much better. Steve, you wanted to talk about Benetton advertisements in particular. Why is that?
Well, there's a new series of Benetton ads. I'll go back a few years. When Tibor Kalman, who was a really amazing art director, was alive, he passed away in 1998, I believe, and Olivero Toscani were in charge of the creative aspects of Benetton, the advertising and the magazine colors, they created some very provocative advertising. And it wasn't advertising that sold clothes, it was advertising that sold ideas. And these ideas were very provocative ones. They were talking about AIDS. They were talking about racial equality. They were talking about racial integration, both sexually and physically in other ways. And they were addressing the boat people coming out of Vietnam. And people criticized that. They thought it was exploitative. You know, here's a clothing company that sells colorful clothing, and they're making hay through all this human misery and
yeah,
human issues.
I remember Benetton getting criticized back then.
Right, but other places have done it too. Ben & Jerry's has put social messages on their packaging. Kenneth Cole has done similarly in billboards and advertising. They use their public face, their canvas, to say something that is important to them as either individuals who run the company, or the company itself has a personality that addresses these issues as well as selling their everyday wares. So Benetton was doing this way before many people were. And, you know, in retrospect and in hindsight, they actually were doing an amazing thing. They were spending large advertising dollars to make people aware of concerns that they should be made aware of. Then they kind of lapsed into just regular commercial advertising. But recently, within the last month, they came out with a campaign called Unhate. And the Unhate campaign is noted for these photoshopped images of famous, very famous people kissing one another. Like the Pope is kissing a Muslim leader. President Obama is kissing the Premier of North Korea. And it goes down the list. There are many of these people kissing the other. With the kiss, which has certainly been used before as a symbol of love, of a symbol of reconciliation, being used here as a sense of not just love, but unhate. And, you know, you can look at it and you can say, well, this is exploitative because it's promoting Benetton, the company. Or you could look at it and say, this is, again, really interesting because they're going out on a limb. They could easily lose customers. They could easily lose support. They could easily be excised from the magazines themselves. And, in fact, what happened with Benetton was the Vatican lodged a complaint that the Pope should not be used in such a manner. Sadly, Benetton pulled the ad.
Huh. I was thinking that it's just the kind of ad that targets their market so that they wouldn't really lose much at all by doing this. In fact, they would gain.
Well, you'd think. I think that's an arguable point. I mean, the ads appeal to me, but I'm not their market. And then there are people who buy the colorful clothes who don't want to be hit in the face with these social issues.
Let's talk for a second about how models are portrayed in fashion photography. This is our regular contributor, Steve Heller. He's a design critic and New York Times columnist. He's creator of the design blog called The Daily Heller. And as you can hear, it is often absolutely fascinating. In fashion photography, I've seen it go through stages. A scene is now created, and sometimes I can't even focus on the clothes. The scenes are so elaborate in newspaper fashion magazines. Then I started looking at one point. This was about maybe 10 years ago. I noticed that all the models, particularly the women, looked like they were off the street and had either crack cocaine or heroin addictions, the way they were made up, the way the clothes were portrayed, the settings they were put in alleyways, dark. I mean, they looked like they were all on, they had very serious addictions. And I thought, what is this about? You know, design-wise, what's the message? What is this?
Well, fashion is very bizarre. You know, what is being used imagistically to convey a style, a mood, an emotion is anybody's guess. I mean, what happens in fashion photography, I can almost see it now. You know, there are the photographers, some of them good and some of them not so good. They're sitting around saying, what can we do to pique the interest of our consumer base? And they go from Richard Avedon creating these amazing tableaux to someone else. I remember when Calvin Klein did those fake porno photographic sessions that were also on TV commercials, and ultimately he pulled them.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were very tawdry.
Yeah.
But they got people talking. And then they got people saying, okay, well, it's tawdry, but let's try it because it actually kind of looks good. You know,
cool.
Fashion can be drawn out of almost anything.
Yeah, I think about Bill Cunningham, who documents fashion for the New York Times.
Great stuff.
Oh, so good. And he, by the way, if nobody has seen that, or if somebody hasn't seen that documentary about his life, I highly recommend it.
It is a fantastic movie. Interestingly, they were editing it in the office next to mine, so I have certain lines that won't get out of my head.
Oh, my goodness. Well, so Bill Cunningham, for those who don't know, does a kind of society page where he goes to all these events and puts pictures of people at society type events and fundraisers around New York. But he also, his best thing is that he gets on a bicycle and he rides all around New York City and he sees what's going on the street with fashion, and then lays it out in the most wonderful way, design-wise, on a page. And so it might be, most recently, it was animal prints. He kept seeing them all over. And
yeah,
all
mostly spotted creatures.
Or he'll say fall, and then it'll be everybody wearing orange or brown. And this sounds very basic, the way I'm describing it, but it is so artfully done. He has such an eye, and his comment about design, you know, his fascination with design coming from the street is what interests me.
And, you know, what he's doing, he's observing And then he's interpreting, he's creating these tableau out of the people who are in a real tableau. But what he's also seeing, whether he states it overtly or not, is that these people are canvases and they're painting themselves. You know, and that's what fashion is. It's about how do you dress yourself up so that you become your own work of art. Certainly it's about expression, whether it's your expression because you're an individual or somebody else's expression because you're buying something that's off the rack. It's all about trying to be individualistic.
Steve, great to talk to you as always, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Regular contributor Steve Heller, design critic, New York Times columnist, and creator of a fantastic design blog called The Daily Heller. Next, Bruce Clements joins us for a talk on aging. What does it mean to grow older? Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Some of our equipment is from Sennheiser. And thanks so much for listening at WNPR.org. You'll find our archive of stories in the search box. Type in the keyword Faith, F-A-I-T-H. What is aging? Satchel Paige once said, "How old would you be if you didn't know how old you was?" Here by phone to talk with me about age is longtime, very longtime contributor Bruce Clements. Bruce, happy 80th birthday.
Thank you very much.
Do you agree with Satchel Paige?
Yeah, actually I do. And it is so that one, when you are sort of reminded of your age, it ought to be always a slight shock.
I agree. Well, everybody says when you look in the mirror, you're still a certain age inside, and the vision in the mirror is a shock.
Who is this guy?
Exactly. So you had a party for your birthday.
We had a party. We had lots of family and extended family, that is to say our oldest daughter's in-laws, Chicago area in-laws, and it was a Hobbit birthday party where the birthday person gets to give presents to everybody who comes, and nobody knew that. I mean, a couple of people knew it ahead, but most people didn't know it. So, and the presents, at Hannah's suggestion, were not wrapped. So they were just on the plates, and it took you a moment to know, is this a present or is this crockery?
Right. Is it stage setting?
Or is it stage setting? Right. But it was lovely. I had a very dear old friend from Eastern Connecticut State University, Nancy Salter, agreed to make a dress, a 1920s dress, for our oldest grandchild, and she was in on the Hobbit birthday party idea because she was going to wear the dress to the party, and she did, and she looked great.
I read quotes, I read articles about aging well, and I'm always a little taken aback by that idea. On the one hand, I get it. On the other hand, some people aren't so lucky.
Well, and not only that, but it sort of distances yourself from yourself. You know, how am I aging? How am I doing? How is this creature I'm supposed to be when aged playing it out? And what can I do? How can I sort of psych myself out so that I age well? It's just, you know, at a certain point in your life, maybe it's best to just live it.
There is a culture I read about.